Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 20th of March, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're also joined by David Ellis from Strategic Defence Initiatives.
One year feels like the next day these days, doesn't it, Brian?
Well, it was a just-in-time delivery, but we made it. That's the most important thing.
Well, look, let's start with the statement from Number 10 this morning. Apparently, the Prime Minister won't be asking for a long extension. There is a case for giving Parliament a bit more time to agree a way forward, but the people of this country have been waiting nearly 3 years now, so it won't be a long extension. What were they talking about? Well, of course, Article 50 and the extension of that process. Theresa May pushed a letter out today to the European Union. I'm just going to read a little bit of this because it's worthwhile laughing at it a little bit. I had intended to bring the vote back to the House of Commons this week. This is the meaningful vote on her deal. The Speaker of the House of Commons said on Monday that in order to get a further meaningful vote to be brought back to the House of Commons, an agreement would have to be fundamentally different, not different in terms of wording, but different in terms of substance. Some members of Parliament have interpreted this to mean a further change to the deal. This position has made it impossible in practice to call for a further vote in advance of the European Council. The European Council meeting begins tomorrow. However, she continued, it remains my intention to bring the deal back to the House. In advance of that vote, I'd be grateful if the European Council could therefore approve the supplementary documents that President Juncker and I agreed in Strasbourg, putting the government in a position to bring these agreements to the House and confirming the changes to the government's position to Parliament. I also intend to bring forward further domestic proposals that confirm my previous commitments to protect our internal markets, given the concerns expressed about the backstop. On this basis and in the light of the outcome of the European Council, I intend to put forward a motion as soon as possible under Section 13 of the Withdrawal Act 2018 to make the argument for the orderly withdrawal and strong future partnership that the UK economy, its citizen security and the continent's future demands. If the motion is passed, I'm confident that Parliament will proceed to ratify the deal constructively, but this will not be completed before 29th of March. And so she goes on to say that she wants an extension until the 30th of June 2019. But, you know, we don't have to worry because this is what she said. I share the public's frustration at Parliament's failure to take a decision. She's a liar, liar. Sorry, I'm not sure what happened there. A bit of a glitch in the stream, I think. But Mr. Juncker went on to say this. As long as we don't know what Britain will say yes to, we can't come to a resolution. So it's at this point still fairly uncertain whether the European Union is going to be willing to grant this extension to the Article 50 process. My suspicion is that they will, despite all the rhetoric. But look, what I think is really going on here, Brian, is that Theresa May is doing what Jeremy Corbyn has been accusing her of in recent weeks and months, running this right up to the backstop and in the hope that she can pressure Parliament to pass her vote. But in the meantime, Donald Trump Jr. has decided to weigh in on the Brexit debate, and he has published this article in The Telegraph. Theresa May should have taken my father's advice on Brexit. So, of course, Trump Jr. is the son of the current US president, and he criticises Theresa May for having ignored Donald Trump's advice. He said this, some pro-Brexit politicians even suggest that Mrs. May is trying to sabotage Brexit. I don't know where he gets that impression from, by insisting that Parliament agree to a deal that essentially keeps Britain bound to the EU indefinitely. Well, as we've just said, Theresa May is intending to bring this deal back to Parliament once again. Apparently, according to Channel 4 News and other sources, apparently she is intending to bring this back next Thursday. That's on the day before we're due to leave. So she's got to run it right up to the limit in terms of time, in the hope of putting pressure on Parliament to pass her resolution for her meaningful vote. So Donald Trump Jr. went on to say in his article, with the deadline fast approaching, it appears that democracy in the UK is all but dead. Well, That's perhaps a little ironic, bearing in mind that pretty much exactly the same type of process is going on in the United States at the moment around Donald Trump's presidency with regard to Russiagate and other allegations of wrongdoing. So, you know, democracy seems to be dead both sides of the Atlantic in these circumstances. But last night, Brian, on Channel 4 News, Jon Snow was asking some questions of a couple of journalists. He made this point.
Domestically, you're kind of talking about a complete disintegration of the political system. Yeah. Parliament's failed, the cabinet's failed, mm-hmm. The whole idea of relating with Europe has failed. I mean, at what point does somebody blow a whistle and say, all change, time to do something, government, national unity, election?
So, Brian, everything has failed. And really, he's saying this with some incredulity, as if he can't really believe that it's happening. But if we look at the timeline over the last 2.5-3 years, there really should be no surprise to anybody that we're in this position, because it has been quite clearly engineered all the way along.
Very cleverly engineered. But the problem with the BBC or Jon Snow, whoever it is, they believe their own rhetoric, and they've just been following along the political line for so many years without really delving into it. My mind comes back to Christopher Story's excellent book, The EU Collective Enemy of Its Member States. And in that book was a timeline which said that Britain was to be attacked from within. It was to be destabilised. It was to be broken apart. Families, communities, policing, law and order, education, everything was to be destroyed in order to bring the country to a state of collapse. That is clearly happening. We've had Nick Bowles, Conservative MP, warning us about 4 years ago the Conservatives plan to introduce chaos in public services. Danny Kruger, parliamentary candidate, said the same thing, that the Tories plan to introduce what he called creative chaos in order to bring in a massive change agenda. We're just watching it unfold. And of course, Steve Baker recently said live on the Westminster camera that the big problem was, whilst the British people had clearly voted to come out of the EU, the ruling political elite had no intention of allowing that to happen. And so what we've seen across Labour, Conservatives and Lib Dems is an orchestrated plot to keep Britain in the European Union by creating chaos at home. It's all there. All the pieces are on the table.
Well, if Jon Snow is expressing concern about there being a constitutional crisis, that institutions are not functioning, that Parliament's not functioning, of course, Parliament in recent weeks attempting to reassert what it's calling parliamentary sovereignty. But let's just remind ourselves that, of course, there is a big question about whether this is even a legitimate Parliament in the first place, because here we have Queen Elizabeth II wearing the wrong hat at the opening of Parliament after the last general election. So maybe I could bring David Ellis into the programme at this point. David, there is a question about the legitimacy of this Parliament and the legitimacy of the entire political process that we're seeing at the moment. This is a constitutional crisis, but not one which has happened by accident or organically. It's come as the result, as we're going to see in a second, of systematic constitutional destruction and so on. So just what are your thoughts on this?
Well, the situation is sort of been articulated by Baker and Suella, the other MP who went before the committee, and basically said the same thing. What we're dealing with is MPs have lost competence. And as we've seen from the 1948 top secret paper, that this process started in 48 in the Cabinet Office, the engine room of government. You know, it's been made the engine room of government, whereas Parliament should be the engine room. It's actually now been hived off in secret into the Cabinet Office. So people are now referring to this Parliament as a disgrace. It's a disgraceful Parliament, and that's correct. It is. But that's not by mistake. That's by weak-willed and incompetent and a lack of integrity and all of the other facets that you would want from your MPs to stand up and do their job. And of course, that's not happening, as we're seeing across the board. But the Act One, Scene One there, I think you've just played the clip of the Queen in Parliament, haven't you, in her blue dress with the... You've just played it, yeah?
Yes, yeah. That's right, yes.
So you've Act One, Scene One, you know, surely everybody sort of saw at that point, you know, we were in for trouble. Christopher Story obviously had it absolutely bang on. He had all the... He'd done his research and got all the pieces on the table there and could see the sort of, the thing unfolding. But it's because the MPs are not doing their job. No doubt, these are not new problems, but of course it was always counterbalanced by the fact we'd got some sort of quorum and weight of sensible counsel in Parliament. And we're struggling now, clearly, you know, we're really struggling.
David, some people would ask, what does it matter what hat the Queen is wearing? But of course, if she's not wearing the crown when she makes the speech at the opening of Parliament, she is not there on her oath. She's not there in her office, as it were, as the monarch. She's there as Elizabeth, the human being. So in fact, if you don't follow the parliamentary procedure, you don't have a legitimate parliament. Where does the Constitution stand under those circumstances?
Well, you're hearing a lot of chatter and traffic at the moment, spurting out all over the place of a constitutional crisis. Now, that's not it. We've got people with an agenda that have a crisis with the Constitution. There's a lack of understanding for people to, or MPs particularly, to enforce the Constitution, because they're asking Mays, unless they've got a pre-1920 version, don't have the correct detail in them. And as we're seeing, we're not getting proper advice from the Cabinet Office. The Parliamentary Library is just the government line, so that's more Cabinet Office. So we're not really getting the sense that we should do, because the whole thing is totally skewed. And where Lilibet's concerned there, sitting on the throne in civilian outfit, in plain clothes, you know, for it to be in a proper parliament, surely someone should have said, you know, at that stage, hang on a minute. If the constitutional monarch, or bound, you know, is a constitutionally limited monarch, you know, so we do have a constitution. It's apparent right there in that part, which I'm sure everybody understands. When she comes in as the state opening of Parliament, that's in regalia with the crown on her head, i.e. the crown in Parliament. That didn't happen. So we've just seen, really, you know, from that point on, we have seen since the Brexit referendum and the vote, and the general election then, and this new parliament under Theresa May, just an utter farce from top to bottom. And it's being allowed because the MPs are not doing their job.
Brian, I'm being criticised in the chat box for suggesting that Elizabeth was a human being. But anyway, that's another matter.
Yeah. Well, David, I'm just going to push a point with you that it's a farce. But this is orchestrated farce. Behind the scenes, there are people controlling this very, very carefully to ensure that the delay is there, the chaos, the smoke screen, the confusion. All of this is carefully choreographed, is probably the right expression, because the people behind the scenes do not want us to leave the European Union, and they're doing everything possible. In fact, they are now going for the full breakdown of UK. The government has admitted that they can't govern the country. I can understand people are a bit upset that we can't govern the country anymore, but don't worry, give us another 3 months and we might be able to work it out. This is very serious stuff. I'm going to say it's treason, because the people driving the real agenda deep in the heart of the government, and certainly inside the Cabinet Office, they know full well what they're doing. But thank you very much to this sharp-eyed viewer that sent us this little email. So this is from Alison. I just wondered if you've read this appalling, though perhaps well-intentioned, ignorance. This is a Daily Telegraph article. Would written constitution have prevented the Brexit quagmire? I shared John Bingley's recent letter from your website along with his YouTube video in the comments section below. But that's also full of people that think we don't have a written constitution. So this is the great deception. And let's have a look here at the Telegraph, absolutely drawing people into this lie. Would a written constitution have prevented this Brexit quagmire? And this is by, I think he's a deputy editor, Philip Johnson of the Telegraph. So we're not dealing with lightweights here. Let's have a look at what he had to say. It was always likely that May would make a mess of Brexit, but I thought the blame would lie with Theresa, not Erskine. The latter May, apparently no relation to Philip May, the Prime Minister's husband, has been thrust onto the Brexit stage through his invocation by the Speaker, John Bercow, on Monday. Anyone who's worked at Westminster over the years, whether as MP, political aide or journalist, is aware of Erskine May. It is the parliamentary rule book, often quoted but rarely read. This is not surprising since it costs about £350 and has only this year been made available online. So we've got a supposedly experienced journalist getting into this subject. I'll just bring one more thing. This was the end of the paragraph you can see before you get behind the paywall. It said it's regularly updated by the parliamentary clerks. He's talking about Erskine May book, the priesthood of procedure and keepers of the Holy Writ. And I was absolutely fascinated by this, Mike, because this journalist has no idea what he's actually talking about. He then quotes a book, makes a joke about it. It's some sort of Holy Writ. No idea what he's talking about. Who is the man? Well, if you have a look at his Twitter page, we get some clue and not much of a clue, because it's essentially a stale Twitter account. But I did notice that on the 21st of October 2013, he said this: we need to take a stand against Europeanisation of justice. But if we're seeing the European Union move in on our justice system, it's moving in on our constitution. So why didn't he pick this up in 2013? There's another one here. This is the 10th, I think, if I can just make it out on the screen. Where are we? This is the 10th of October 2013. Very good piece by Joshua Rosenberg. Why bother repealing human rights law when the EU can override? This could be big. Well, it's huge, because what he's admitting here is that the EU has taken over the constitution. So in 2013, he failed to understand what was going on. And in 2019, he's just as ignorant. Mm. So we took a little bit of a delve into who's saying what. UCL here in London, the Constitution Unit, is one of the key sources of supposedly information. But this all gets pretty ropey. We'll just read a little bit of it. It's been suggested the British Constitution could be summed up in 8 words. What the Queen in Parliament enacts is law. That's the 8 words. Basically, they then say that parliamentary sovereignty is commonly regarded as the defining principle of the British Constitution. This is the first lie, because the people are sovereign, not Parliament itself. But here we've got supposedly experts telling people what's what. They ram it home, the sovereign Westminster Parliament here, completely untrue. And then down here it says parliamentary sovereignty may now be called in question given the combined impact of Europe, devolution, the courts and human rights. So Parliament, according to this, is sovereign. But even so, the Europeans can come in and pull it this way, or devolution can pull it the other way. There's no solid base, according to UCL. It's all, what's the word, pick and mix, or whatever the expression is. It goes on. It says British Constitution derived from a number of sources, statutes and laws passed by Parliament, etc. It does say that common law is developed by the courts. And in fact, it should say the juries. It says the judges. The UK's accession to the European Communities Act 1972 has meant European law is increasingly impacting on the British Constitution. Well, if a foreign power is impacting on our constitution, that's either an act of war or treason by means of the people who are helping to permit it. So it seems that UCL here is woefully ignorant as to what's actually going on. It then says correctly, well, it's not a written constitution because our constitution is written down in a number of places, but it should be codified. So they say an uncodified constitution creates problems. But this bit here, the flexibility of the UK constitution is evident from the large number of constitutional reforms since 1997, including the abolition of the majority of hereditary peers in the House of Lords, introduction of codified rights of individuals, first time in the Human Rights Act. So we've got more of the lie that we can simply move the constitution and bend it for whatever the political whim is.
Well, what they've acknowledged there is the absolute constitutional vandalism, which began with Tony Blair. And David's talking about earlier on, David is talking about, power being moved into the Cabinet Office away from Parliament and so yes. on. This was a process that began with Tony Blair. The Prime Minister's office is a sort of subset within the Cabinet Office. We've heard David talking about the Pearl Office. There is a lot going on within the Cabinet Office that is really not understood by the general public. They don't appreciate that it's the Cabinet Office that generates policy and feeds it out to the departments rather than the other way around. And in fact, the way that I mean, they're quite right when they say that Europe is increasingly infringing on our constitution, because, of course, what seems to have been built since Tony Blair and subsequently by David Cameron and by Theresa May is almost a European model in the UK with, you know, the Cabinet Office almost serving the role of the European Commission.
Yep. Well, let's follow it through. If we just put that one back on screen, just highlight this bit down here. For an overview of the UK system of government, visit direct.gov. The UK Cabinet Manual also provides an outline of British government, albeit from the executive's point of view. There's a new word there, the executive. What does that actually mean in a constitutional sense? But David, you've warned about this Cabinet document. Let's just have a look at it and then we'll bring you in for some comment. So where do we go? Well, we found this paper online, the government response to comments received on the draft Cabinet Manual. And it says here, in February 2010, the then Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Gordon Brown MP, asked the Cabinet Secretary to lead work to produce a Cabinet Manual. A draft chapter on elections and government formation was published that month and considered by the House of Commons Justice Committee. So Tony Blair and then came in on the back of Gordon Brown, as you say, Mike. Following the 2010 general election, the Prime Minister, the Right Honourable David Cameron MP, and Deputy Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Nick Clegg, endorsed the principle of the Cabinet Manual, and the Cabinet Office published a draft Cabinet Manual on the 14th of December 2010. This is very sneaky stuff, because essentially they are drifting the meaning of our constitution by this guide to MPs, ignorant backbench MPs who don't know better. It says the Cabinet Manual was published in draft in order to achieve two main aims. First, to ensure that as far as possible, it reflects an agreed position on important constitutional conventions. Well, either we have a standing constitution, which is a rock foundation, or this thing is some sort of jelly which we can push in any direction we want. I suspect this is what this document is doing. So there we are, constitutional conventions. And if we go on to the introduction here, it's back on the subject of the Political and Constitutional Reform Committee. So all of this debated out of sight of the public and then actually brought in. And here's the document itself, the Cabinet Manual. And the introduction is by David Cameron, of course. On entering government, I set out the Deputy Prime Minister our shared desire for a political system that's looked at with admiration around the world and is more transparent and accountable. So we're to believe that prior to David Cameron appearing, we didn't really know what was going on.
No, indeed.
No. Okay, well, if we can just pop that one back. The other person who comes in here is your favourite, Sir Gus O'Donnell. And he's waxing lyrical that New Zealand had one of these sorts of documents, but it took them decades to bring it in. whereas they've managed to do this one in 2 years. This is the start of the rot, David. And I'm just going to come back to UK column here. 2013, we were warning, treason softly spoken. Shall we consent to their new Bill of Rights or let our constitutional common law guard our freedoms? So we were spot on. And in that particular edition, we had two key articles. One was warning how Theresa May, the Home Secretary, was introducing effectively a Stasi-style system in this country, contrary to common law and the Constitution. And I think this was yours, Mike, the 21st anniversary of Maastricht treason charges. And this is the one talking about Rodney Atkinson and his team, who in the early days took charges of treason to police stations in UK and north of the border. I'll just read you the introduction. On the 9th of September 1993, Rodney Atkinson and the late Norris McWhirter laid before the Magistrates Court in Hexham, Northumberland, under the process known as misprision of treason, 7 counts of treason against the British Constitution and people by 2 ministers who'd signed the Treaty of Maastricht in 1992. And that article, which you can freeze on screen, shows some of the charges. There's another 2 not shown. And of course, the people who were mainly in the frame for this were Francis Maud and Douglas Hurd. But not surprising, the CPS simply threw it out. Yeah. David, this cabinet manual is extremely dangerous because this is the perverted document which most MPs now base their constitutional knowledge upon.
Absolutely correct. It's almost as if the existing constitution has been kicked in the stinger since the 1920s, and the current tranche of MPs are not aware or are paying it any regard. So when you produce new documentation, which is what's happened there under all of that, they're getting a completely distorted view of actually what the truth and the reality is. So obviously we've got the John Bingley paper up there on the website, but there is also a book that John has produced, and it's called Understanding the Written Parts of the Constitution. We're going to have to somehow get this available for everyone, because this is the stuff that we need to have propagated. But in short, the conclusions that John brings there at the end of that paper on the UK column website are the important bit to take away and go and propagate around to as many people as you can, and then put to your MP. But clearly there's a drive here for a new constitution to be written, and this is going to sort of allow them to carry on with the free-for-all. I can just sort of finish with one anecdotal source from a colleague who's just come from a meeting within Westminster yesterday, saying that he'd had a top civil servant that had come out of the MOD saying to him that as far as they were concerned, they were going to kick this thing called Brexit into the stingers and run the clock out until we have another general election and then go back into the EU. And that was the opinion from within the Cabinet Office. Now, this particular source had said that he'd had that from 5 other top civil servants saying the same story. So we can see the pattern here. And I've got to go back to what one admiral that I worked with right at the very start of Brexit had said, is that this is what they were going to do. So obviously there's some people out there that have got an idea of what's going on here, but we just need more of a quorum. And we need more of a quorum quickly.
Absolutely right. But look, let's just keep this in mind, of course, because as the EU themselves have said, and, you know, again, most people aren't really noticing, there's 2 parts of this. At this point, we're only at the first part. This is the divorce agreement. We haven't even begun the process of, I mean, there's a political declaration which sets out a framework for the future relationship with the EU, but we haven't begun that negotiation yet. And the key point here, David, is that even if the worst happens, the worst in inverted commas, as far as some people are concerned, even if the worst happens, and we were to, in quotes, crash out on the 29th of March, the fact is that our people's desire to have a relationship with the European Union isn't going to disappear at that point. And there's going to be a negotiation begins to try to work out what our future relationship is going to be. So you know, Brexit without the exit is always what's on the cards here, because ultimately we're going to be brought back in some other form.
Absolutely correct. Unless there is a new government and a new cabinet of people of substance that are prepared to go into the cabinet office, switch it off, stop its current course where it's been tasked and designated to unify Britain into the EU and the EU into Britain, nothing will change. We can have vote after vote or shenanigans after shenanigans unless that is what happens. There has to be a quorum and a cabinet. Go into the cabinet office, turn it off, switch it off completely, retask, and more importantly, reappoint. They have to reappoint because the whole engine room of the British government is set to do this. And this is what Steve Baker was articulating in committee. He had no impact as a minister because the civil servants there are leading it 100% from the cabinet office with no resistance from whatever. All that's happening in Theresa May's government is they're rubber stamping everything.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Well, we're just a mention here for Ned, who is our excellent cartoonist for the UK column. He's decided just to go with it. And so for the 29th, we've got the Brexit Party. I'll just bring up, this is actually his sheet advertising it. You can have a look at that if you freeze that on screen. But this is the details. Coney West and Village Hall, 7 p.m. onwards, the 29th of March. Brexit, bring a bottle party and whatever else you deem fit. No deal, hard deal, soft deal, what nonsense. We can agree deals where necessary, trade and thrive. It will not prevent travelling to, working in or living in France, Germany, Spain, etc. Cheer up, as Captain Mannering would say, carry on, Wilson. So we applaud Ned for saying, well, whatever happens on the 29th, he's encouraging people to come and have some fun. But when the party's over, as you say, David, we really need to take bring these people to book and to get a proper government installed in Westminster.
Right. So Theresa May has written her letter. Her letter's gone off. And then tomorrow she will head over to Brussels for the European Council meeting, which is taking place tomorrow and Friday. Well, one of the other things that's going on there is they're going to be discussing the upcoming summit with China. We'll talk about that in a second. Also, ways to tackle disinformation. So the European Union absolutely on the case with that. So this upcoming summit with China, this is of great concern to the European Union, apparently, mainly because Italy has decided that it's going to go ahead and join the Belt and Road Initiative. So Xi Jinping is heading over to Europe. He's going to Rome, I believe, tomorrow. This European Council meeting, very concerned about that. Italy needs to prevent the commercial opportunities that will emerge from Rome's participation in China's Belt and Road Initiative from becoming a tool of geopolitical hegemony. That's according to Mario Borghesio, who's a European Parliament member for the Lega Party in Italy. We'll come on to that in a second. But if we just run through some of the headlines here, this is the Daily Mail. Xi to visit Italy, France, as Rome joins New Silk Road. Italy's drive to join China's Belt and Road hits potholes, says Reuters. As Xi heads to Italy, China takes Belt and Road controversy in its stride. Actually, the European Union has been going nuts about this, about the fact that Italy would be doing this. This is the Guardian's take on it. Italy rattles US and EU with likely support for China's Belt and Road. And as I say, here's the Sputnik article with the quote from the European Parliament member for the Lega Party. He said the main concern of Lega is to prevent this important commercial opportunity from becoming also a tool of political hegemony. I wasn't clear whether he was concerned about the potential for Chinese geopolitical hegemony or EU geopolitical hegemony. But anyway, Italy will become the first of the G7 nations to support China's multi-trillion dollar Belt and Road plan And it says Sputnik, the participation in BRI is not expected to allow China to support important infrastructure projects. Sorry, not only expected to allow China to support important infrastructure projects in Italy, mainly in the south, and access the rest of Europe through at least ports, but also give Italian producers the opportunity to enter the Chinese market. There's lots of talk in the media about fear. The EU fearing the accord with China will stir up divisions with member states because of China's expansionist goals. Also concerns about China benefiting from the debt traps that they're applying to poorer countries. So everywhere you look, the Western media trying to overlay the kinds of gags that the West has played on emerging markets on what the Chinese are doing. And so far, we haven't seen any evidence that that's what the Chinese are doing. They seem to be, as they keep saying, working towards a win-win scenario. It's the West that has been pushing debt traps through the IMF and the World Bank over the decades on African and Asian countries. So we'll see how this goes. But in the meantime, Italy intending to join the Belt and Road and the EU not very happy about it.
Presumably sanctions on Italy might, because China's an enemy. Gavin Williamson has said that China is an enemy. So
well, there's already heavy pressure on Italy over their budget because Italy refuses to capitulate in the way that Greece did to EU demands to run their budget in a particular way. So well, who knows? It could come to that. But remember, we've got to remember Italy is a founding member of the EU, so it's much harder for them to bully Italy in the way that they've bullied Greece in the past.
Yeah. If China's on the move, so's 43 Commando. And we had this little tip-off. It said this. I got a tip today. 43 Commando being moved into Fazley Naval Base rather than just one squadron, which was based there before. MOD is buying up large amounts of land from Luss Estates and others as training ground for them. The source is well connected, but can lack judgment, so I want to get confirmation before we go public, starting with some internet public source searches. Well, we've also done a little bit of work on this, and something is happening. It's difficult to tell what, but the silence is perhaps interesting.
Well, in fact, if we go back to January last year, so it's January 2018, and this was the headline in the Plymouth Herald. MOD says Royal Marines Superbase in Plymouth will go ahead. So this was plans to create this superbase in Plymouth and Torr Point. This was amid concerns, according to the Herald at the time, that two of the city's amphibious assault ships would be axed, as well as 1,000 Royal Marine posts. But the MOD had confirmed that that Devonport is due to remain an amphibious centre for specialisation. So over a year ago, this was all looking very good. But we've got to put this in a little bit of context. Because, of course, this is part of the fusion doctrine. This was the establishment of Joint Forces Command, the sort of integration, the unification of certain functions across government. If we remember that Oliver Dowden, Cabinet Office Minister, said that transforming the government estate to make it operate more efficiently, this is part of the whole fusion doctrine thing, and save taxpayers' money is clearly something to be proud of. Well, in fact, this process began earlier than that. This is from April 2016, the consolidation of the so-called public estate into what they were describing then as one public estate. So if, nonetheless, January 2018, everything was sounding very good, it seems less good now, because this is what the Plymouth Herald was reporting just a couple of weeks ago. There are fears for the future of the planned superbase in Plymouth, housing all Royal Marines after it was announced two other West Country Marine bases won't be closed. So this is Chivenor in North Devon and Norton Manor in Somerset were set to be shut down because of the consolidation process. But the Defence Secretary a couple of weeks ago revealed that those closures have been scrapped. And that has thrown doubt on the future of the superbase in Plymouth, because it's already been announced that Stonehouse Barracks and the Citadel are to be shut down. And this, according to the Herald, will leave the Royal Marines homeless. So the question is, where are they going to go? And, the information we have seems to suggest that that was going to be Faslane.
It's incredible, isn't it? We've got all this major change in the military structure, no clear debate in Westminster at all. It just happens. This is the Cabinet Office. David, what do you make of the idea that we've now got the whole of 43 Commando going to Faz Lane? What is that about?
Well, when you look at the overall picture there, just where the Royal Marine issues are concerned, you've got all this ping pong going on where everybody's getting spun a bit down in Devon, aren't they? We're going to shut Chivenor, keep it open. We're going to shut Norton Manor. We're going to shut Stonehouse. There's all sorts of shenanigans, isn't there? Nobody's really got a real grip. You're all spinning round. You've got the MPs failing to look at the bigger picture, the bigger defence scene, and sort of what are they attempting to do? Just stabilise the vote and deal with whoever's campaigning for the closures. But they're not dealing with the bigger issue, of course, which is that you're quite right, under that fusion policy, which is a policy of single point command and control, clearly what you're seeing there is they're going to be building something up there in Faz Lane. So you beg the question, surely, don't you, that is the Royal Marine Superbase going to be up in Faz Lane? So if that's the case, when are they going to do it? Could that be after the next general election? And then we'll see, you know, if that was the case, would Chivenor and Limpston and all the other places, Norton Manor, will they be closing? And then we really will have all the eggs in one basket, as Admiral Lord Boyce said. So, you know, that's we've got a lot of questions here because something's going on, clearly.
Yeah. And there's definitely EU policy behind it. But if you want a little bit more information on 43 Commando, you can find it on the internet quite easily. Elite UK Forces here reporting details about them and their history. In principle, the core of them are defending Britain's nuclear deterrent and weapons supplies, weapons stockpiles. So that's the key thing. But it appears that all of that is going to be expanded. We've had a recent new CO come in. Now, if I've got this right, it's Colonel Tony DeRea, who's the man in charge now on the right of your screen. Had a little look at his Twitter page. I'm just fascinated that the important thing seems to be LGBT issues. And OK, if there were one or two tweets, you could say, well, that's MOD policy. But we've got this one here that's pushed out. They're getting very excited because for the first time ever, the LGBT flag has been flown over the Clyde. But these things just go on and on. We wonder whether any proper Royal Marines work is going on or there's a totally different agenda within this commando.
David, of course, you're talking about the larger defence picture, and that naturally brings us back to Defence Union, because this is all happening, as you say, single point command and control. We'll just remind people, of course, that you know, while there's been a lot of talk in the mainstream press in the last couple of months about the fact that Merkel and Macron have both talked about this Defence Union, the German Foreign Office had tweeted this out last year, saying we are in the process of transforming the EU into a genuine security and defence union. We've had videos from the European Parliament talking about defence union, as you will see here in one second. This was a little promotional video from the European Parliament talking about a range of different issues, including defence union. But the point about this video is that this was in fact tweeted out by the European Parliament in 2016. This is 20th of November 2016. The European Parliament November plenary starts tomorrow. EU-Turkey talks, defence union, air quality, Lux Prize and more. Watch our video. So this has been going on for quite some time. And as we've highlighted on many occasions, we've got British military officers quite happy to be photographed beside the EU flag rather than the Union flag. And so, David, I think the question has to be asked then, or of our MPs, do they support? I think everybody needs to be asking their MPs, do you support Defence Union? Because it seems to me now that we have done quite a bit of work in the last few months, just to finish this off, quite a bit of work in the last few months to get the views of MPs on Defence Union, to get statements from government on Defence Union. We've discovered, for example, that this is such a hot potato that the only way that any communication can happen on this subject is when it's based on a template letter, which seems to have come out of the Cabinet Office again. And so, you know, when there's that level of control over the narrative on this, and nobody in the House of Commons, not one of the 650, really speaking out about it, we've got to assume that their silence means that they consent to it.
That is the question, isn't it? Silence is consent. If they're not speaking out, surely, you know, it begs the question, you know, do you support it? So this is really what people need to take away from this and ask and propagate in any way that you can. You know, go to your MP. Do you support? Ask them directly in any way you can. Do you support EU Defence Union? And then press for an answer. It's very, very important that we all do this now, because Theresa May's security is Defence Union. And I can assure everyone, I've had a source come back from Westminster, from Parliament yesterday, saying that he'd just been in a meeting with a large number of Tory MPs, and they were refusing to talk about it. They were refusing to talk about Defence Union. It is not a question of them not knowing about it, because they do. It's a question of them being silent. So we've even got a number of MPs wondering why they're not being lobbied by big defence companies anymore. Well, of course, why would they? Because the MPs are making themselves redundant. They're no longer relevant, because Parliament very soon won't have competence over our own military or defence in any way, shape or form. Because that's the whole point of single point EU-controlled defence union. They control all of it, everything. Capital budget, operational budget, policy, internal and external. So please, please, everyone, freeze the screen there where Mike had put up. You know, go to your MP and ask them directly. Phone them, tweet them, write to them, email them. Do you support Defence Union? And press for an answer.
Yeah. Right. Well, look, we'll just end this section with this one, because, of course, you're talking about single point command and control. And this is really the point that you've been trying to drive home for quite some time, David. The European Union is building itself into a federalist superstate. We've known that for a very long time. We've had monetary union. We're now having banking union. Military union is on the cards. Well, here's another one. Because energy union, EU has now awarded €323 million grant to the Baltic Synchronization Project at policy conference on interconnected energy grids. So energy union is the next single point control dimension of the European Union. They are, every possible policy area is being unified, Brian, and really this is not part of the Brexit discussion either.
Yeah. In the chat box, somebody have said that when they spoke to their MP, they, you know, simply denied it. So what can you do? Well, what you do is you say to the MP, why are you not telling the truth? Stick with, are they telling the truth or not? Because this is the bit that plays on their minds and keeps the pressure on. We're really out of time now, but I just wanted to say we've had a number of emails this morning giving us information. I'll try and do some of these on Friday, but this is one about a review of the court system. This bit just caught my eye. The event will include the overview of the latest developments in family reform. You will hear about our new digital divorce service, which aims to provide improved, more consistent service for divorcing couples. We'll also seek to overview the work in the public law and adoption. So you can get married in church, and we're really proud in the UK in 2019 you'll be able to get your digital divorce. Perhaps we could divorce the government digitally, Mike. Do you think that would be a good idea? Bye-bye. Just press the button. David, thank you very much for joining us. Serious times, constitution and common law under attack. This is treason. It's misprision of treason. And ultimately, it's going to take the British public to hold the government and its members to account. We'll continue to try and achieve that objective. Mm. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back at the same time on Friday. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.